You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the continent to bring you the truth about cannabis and marijuana law reform.
I smoke pot and I like it a lot.
Yeah! The Rough Belleville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation. Now, here's your host, Radical Russ Belleville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. I'm all perplexed today. It's a holiday. Are we even supposed to be working? Yes, it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world, coming to you live and direct from America's last absolute prohibition state, the state of Idaho. We are celebrating Juneteenth. That's right, folks. It's Juneteenth, the first new federal holiday since Martin Luther King Day in 1983, or at least in most places. In Idaho, they didn't start celebrating that until I think it was 6 years later. And even to this day, it's still called Idaho Human Rights Day / Martin Luther King Day. But Juneteenth celebration happening here on the show, in that we are also looking at the beginning of the end of the war on those people using certain non-pharmaceutical, non-alcoholic, tobacco-free drugs. In fact, it was just 50 years ago, this last Thursday, when this happened.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
That's right. That's President Richard Nixon on June 17th, 1971, in a nationally televised address declaring the war on drugs. And so that's going to be our focus for today's show, the 50th anniversary of the war on drugs. Coming up in the Cannabis Focus, we'll give you the full clip, the full 4 minutes of Richard Nixon declaring the war on drugs. And how much is that going to cost us, Tricky Dick?
If we're going to have a successful offensive, we need more money. Consequently, I'm asking the Congress for $155 million in new funds, which will bring the total amount this year in the budget for drug abuse, both in enforcement and treatment, to over $350 million.
Ooh, $350 million for drug enforcement. You know what it is today, kids, 50 years later? $3.1 billion, almost 10 times as much as it was in Nixon's day. So we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about how the war on drugs was a bipartisan crusade and how the Democrats, including the current president, had a lot to do with it. And then in the radical rant, we're going to take a look at how we're recovering from the war on drugs, the push for social equity in cannabis laws. Connecticut is set to legalize pretty soon with some social equity provisions as well. I've got a radical provision for social equity. I think we should learn a lesson from the 1980s, since we're going to be talking about the 1980s today, and treat marijuana like Indian casinos. Then coming up in hour two, we're going to look at how the war on drugs pervaded our television sets in the 80s and 90s, and how the government actually spent money to basically bribed Hollywood writers to write anti-drug scripts for them. And we've got a few clips from things like Different Strokes and Home Improvement to make the point. Also coming up, we'll talk about drug testing and how that's starting to fall away as the war on drugs is losing its support among the American people. We got some polling we'll talk about as well. People do not support the war on drugs anymore, and neither does Amazon, which will no longer be drug testing for marijuana. Also, we'll take a look at how far we've come, how now there are more legal marijuana states now than there were medical marijuana states before legalization. All that coming up on today's Russ Belleville Show, followed up with Hour 2's Toker Talk Radio. We hope you stay tuned for that as well. We're coming to you live from the Idaho-Oregon border. And right now, let's get to the rest of the states and the federal government with the news.
This is your Cannabis Headline News, brought to you every weekday by Radical Russ Radio at RadicalRuss.com, your 24-hour source for marijuana music and cannabis conversations. Subscribe today for just $4.20 at patreon.com/radicalruss. With your cannabis headline news for the week ending Friday, June 11th, 2021, I'm Russ Belleville. This is your Cannabis Headline News, brought to you every weekday by Radical Russ Radio at RadicalRuss.com, your 24-hour source for marijuana music and cannabis conversations. Subscribe today for just $4.20 at patreon.com/radicalruss. With your cannabis headline news for the week ending Friday, June 18th, 2021, I'm Russ Belville. The governor of Louisiana on Tuesday signed a bill to decriminalize marijuana possession. But Governor John Bel Edwards challenged the narrative that the legislation actually decriminalizes low-level cannabis possession, emphasizing that possessing up to 14 grams of marijuana does carry a $100 fine under the bill. But replacing the threat of incarceration with a modest fine does fit the definition of decriminalization used by reform advocates. Louisiana lawmakers also sent Edwards a separate bill this month to let patients in the state's medical cannabis program legally smoke whole plant marijuana flower. He hasn't weighed in on that proposal yet, but he's previously cited it as an example of the type of incremental reform he expected to advance. Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed a bill to modestly expand the state's limited medical marijuana program on Tuesday. The legislation adds cancer and post-traumatic stress disorder to the list of conditions that qualify patients to legally access cannabis. It also doubles the amount of THC concentration that is allowed from 0.5% to 1%. As originally passed in the House, the bill would have also included chronic pain as a qualifying condition, but that was removed by the Senate and was not re-added in a conference committee. The House-approved version also increased the THC limit to 5%, but that too was watered down in the Senate. Abbott has not yet commented on a separate piece of drug policy reform legislation that the legislature also passed to require the state to study the therapeutic potential of psychedelics like psilocybin and MDMA. Connecticut is on the verge of legalizing marijuana after lawmakers sent a cannabis reform bill to the desk of the state's supportive governor on Thursday. The latest action, a Senate vote of 16 to 11, caps a drama-filled week that at one point saw Governor Ned Lamont issue a threat to veto the legislation he largely supports over a specific provision on equity licensing eligibility. On Wednesday, the bill passed the House of Representatives, which had amended the version adopted by the Senate a day earlier to remove the controversial language, necessitating Thursday's final vote on concurrence. If Lamont signs the bill into law as expected, possession of marijuana by adults 21 and older will become legal on July 1st. Commercial cannabis sales could begin as soon as next May, but the bill does not specify an exact start date. The Florida Supreme Court has killed another marijuana legalization ballot initiative, invalidating the proposal on Thursday because a majority of justices said its summary is misleading. This is the second citizen initiative that the court has nullified this year that would have established a regulated marijuana market in the state. Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody's office requested a review of both initiatives with the court and filed briefs opposing the petitions, and now the justices have handed down another defeat to reform advocates. As in the past case, the ruling was decided based on a statutory challenge of a single phrase. The ballot summary uses the words limited use in reference to activities that would be made lawful for adults. Quote, the ballot summary plainly tells voters that the proposed amendment limits the personal use, that is, consumption, of recreational marijuana by age-eligible persons, but the proposed amendment itself does not do so, end quote, a five-justice majority wrote. Before the Colorado legislative session ended last week, House Bill 1317 had been amended close to 30 times. It's now on Governor Jared Polis's desk, along with plenty of complaints from medical marijuana patients and cannabis industry stakeholders who are urging him to veto the bill that would add many layers to the state's marijuana regulations. House Bill 1317 reduces the possession limit on cannabis concentrates to 8 grams, mandates the formation of a committee to study high-potency concentrates, and requires recommending physicians to conduct mental health evaluations and set marijuana potency limits for patients. For patients aged 18 to 20, the bill limits concentrate possession to 2 grams, requires the patient receive recommendations from 2 unaffiliated physicians, and recertification every 6 months unless the patient is homebound. In addition, the bill creates a statewide purchasing database to control daily purchase limits and requires coroners to report THC levels in all non-natural deaths. Anti-marijuana groups in Montana have moved to dismiss their own lawsuit challenging a voter-approved legalization measure after the governor signed separate reform legislation into law. Safe Montana and Wrong for Montana say their lawsuit is no longer necessary since Governor Greg Gianforte signed HB 701 last month. They filed a motion to dismiss the case in the Montana First Judicial Court late last week.
The lawsuit attempted to make the case that the voter-approved Initiative 190 was unconstitutional because it appropriated some cannabis tax revenue, allegedly violating a portion of the state constitution that prohibits such activity from being included in a citizen initiative. Because of the enactment of the legalization implementation bill that saw the legislature get its chance to steer cannabis revenue, as well as a separate bill that prohibits ballot measures from appropriating funds, opponents said the legal challenge was no longer needed. A Rhode Island Senate committee on Monday approved a marijuana legalization bill that's being championed by leadership in the chamber. It's the first time a bill to legalize cannabis for recreational use has ever advanced in the state. The Judiciary Committee, which previously held an April hearing on the reform legislation, as well as a competing proposal from the governor, passed the Senate bill in substitute form in a 6-2 vote. A third legalization measure was also recently filed on the House side by Representative Scott Slater and several co-sponsors. Curiously, the Senate panel's action comes just days after House Speaker Joseph Shekarchy signaled that legalization wouldn't be taken up until the summer or fall. The Senate, however, appears to have different plans and is expected to take up its bill for a floor vote as soon as next week. Wyoming lawmakers failed to pass a bill to legalize marijuana this session, but on Friday, two measures were submitted to the state to place medical cannabis legalization and adult use decriminalization measures before the voters on the 2022 ballot. The Libertarian Party and Libertarian State Representative Marshall Burt joined with activists to file the proposed initiatives with the Secretary of State's office. The text of the medical cannabis proposal states that patients could purchase and possess up to 4 ounces of flower and 20 grams of medical marijuana-derived products in a 30-day period. Meanwhile, activists' separate decriminalization measure would impose small fines on people possessing up to 4 ounces of marijuana without the threat of jail time. A first and second offense would be considered a misdemeanor punishable by a $50 fine, while a third and any subsequent offense would be penalized by a $75 fine. Cultivating marijuana would also be considered a misdemeanor punishable by a $200 fine. Petitioners will have until February 14th to collect 41,775 valid signatures from registered voters to make the ballot after the state approves the formatting of the measures. Nebraska marijuana activists are gearing up for a mass-scale campaign to put medical cannabis legalization on the state's 2022 ballot after the legislature failed to pass a bill to enact the reform this session. And since the state Supreme Court invalidated a measure that qualified for the 2020 ballot based on a statutory challenge, voters can expect to see multiple complementary initiatives that are currently being vetted by lawyers to ensure that opponents can't leverage the legal system to block the policy change again. Nebraskans for Medical Marijuana has brought on Christina Eggers as Signature Drive Director, and she told Marijuana Moment that the plan is to, quote, hit the ground running on a mass scale starting on July 1, quote, where you can't go anywhere without somebody being there to collect your signature if you're ready, end quote. An Ohio-based marijuana group is helping campaigns in West Virginia and South Carolina get cannabis decriminalization on their local ballots this year, and progress is already being made. While the Sensible Movement Coalition has traditionally pushed for reforms within Ohio and has seen multiple successes in getting decriminalization enacted there, they're now lending expertise to activist-led campaigns in other traditionally conservative states. SMC's multi-state effort comes as a separate group, Ground Game Texas, announced a new campaign to put marijuana reform measures on local ballots in cities across Texas. 3 years after Oklahoma voters approved legalizing medical marijuana, the state will beef up enforcement of its cannabis laws. State lawmakers this year approved a slate of legislation that allows state agencies to ensure medical marijuana businesses are complying with licensing, testing, operation, and tax requirements. Beginning November 1, medical marijuana patients may also notice some changes the next time they visit a dispensary. Dispensaries will be able to package and sell pre-rolled joints in-house. Some dispensaries currently sell pre-rolled joints, but existing law says only licensed processors can craft and package marijuana cigarettes. Dispensaries also will be able to offer samples of various cannabis strains. Patients won't be able to light up in stores, but they will be able to touch and smell some marijuana bud so long as those samples are for display purposes only and not sold to customers. End quote. The Attorney General of New Jersey on Tuesday sent warning letters to companies that are effectively circumventing the state's marijuana laws by gifting cannabis in exchange for non-marijuana related purchases such as overpriced cookies, brownies, and stickers. Gifting is lawful between adults 21 and older under New Jersey's adult use cannabis law, but a number of businesses are allegedly taking advantage of that policy by giving away free cannabis products to those who purchase other items like snacks or baked goods. No retail marijuana businesses have been licensed since the state enacted recreational legalization earlier this year, which followed voter approval of a reform initiative during the November 2020 election. Licensing regulations still need to be developed before adult use shops can open. A California senator is sponsoring a bill to legalize possession of psychedelics in the state and says the proposal is a step toward eventually decriminalizing all drugs. Senator Scott Wiener made the comments last week in a chat hosted by the Psychedelic and Entheogen Academic Council, discussing next steps for his psychedelics legislation after it passed the Senate earlier this month. He said advancing the measure in the Assembly will be very challenging due to a number of factors, but he sees progress in the legislature. It's also unclear where Governor Gavin Newsom stands on the reform, he said, though the governor has long been an outspoken opponent of the war on drugs. If enacted into law, the bill would remove criminal penalties for possessing or sharing numerous psychedelics, including psilocybin mushrooms, DMT, ibogaine, LSD, and MDMA, for adults 21 and older. Federal marijuana trafficking cases continued to decline in 2020 as more states have moved to legalize, a new analysis from the U.S. Sentencing Commission shows. In an updated fact sheet, the commission, which is an independent agency in the judicial branch of the federal government, analyzed the number of drug trafficking convictions and found that there were 1,118 cannabis cases in fiscal year 2020. That's down two-thirds since 2016, shortly after the first recreational marijuana markets started to mature. Advocates argue that the year-over-year decline corresponds with the growing number of states that have implemented legalization, and it also reflects a federal deprioritization of pursuing cannabis cases despite ongoing prohibition as the war on marijuana continues to lose voter support. Federal prosecutions of drug-related crimes overall increased in 2019, but cases involving marijuana dropped by more than a quarter, according to an end-of-year report released by Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts in December. Civil rights groups are pushing for a vote on a bill to federally legalize marijuana to take place in the U.S. House of Representatives this month, but some activists who have experience in the state-level regulatory space are now proposing changes to the legislation to ensure that the market is equitable and empowers communities that have been most impacted by prohibition to benefit from the new industry. Without the modifications, they say, legal cannabis sales could end up in the hands of a few large corporations, quote, putting most small cultivators and retailers out of business, end quote. The proposals come from the Parabola Center, a newly established organization whose members include Shailene Tidal, a former Massachusetts cannabis regulator, that is working to inform legalization legislation federally and at the state level with the intent of promoting social justice-centered reforms. A first-ever bill to federally decriminalize possession of all currently illicit drugs and incentivize states to follow suit is being introduced in Congress. The measure, which will be filed later this week, is timed to coincide with the 50-year anniversary of President Richard Nixon's declaration of a war on drugs. Representatives Bonnie Watson Coleman and Cori Bush are sponsoring the legislation, titled the Drug Policy Reform Act, drafted in partnership with the Drug Policy Alliance. The proposal would end the threat of incarceration for people caught possessing drugs for personal use. Courts would still have the option of imposing a fine, but that could be waived if a person couldn't afford it. Importantly, the measure would make it so the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, rather than the Justice Department, would be responsible for classifying drugs, with the intent being to shift that role to a health-centric model. A new national poll from Data for Progress and The Lab found that more than 7 in 10 voters, or 71%, believe that federal drug policies are not working and that there is need for reform. Voters no longer want to treat public health issues like drug use and addiction as matters of crime and law enforcement. They support decriminalizing both drug possession, 59%, and the distribution of drugs in small quantities, 55%, while also shifting regulatory power over drugs from the Drug Enforcement Agency to the Department of Health and Human Services, 60%. Interestingly, when asked whether, quote, current federal drug policies are working and there is no need to reform them, end quote, a nearly identical rate of 1 in 5 Democrats and 1 in 5 Republicans agreed that the war on drugs is working, while just 1 in 20 independents agreed with that assessment. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for the week ending Friday, June 18th, 2021. I'm Russ Belville.
Cannabis Headline News is heard at the top of every hour on Radical Russ Radio, and Friday's news is contained within the free Russ Belville Show Live podcast. For daily downloads of Cannabis Headline News podcast to your device every morning, subscribe by becoming a patron of Radical Russ Radio.
Well, that was fun. Supposedly, the news file for this week was supposed to copy over, and it did not. So you got the entertainment value of watching me scramble to do the news live. Hey! Anyway, coming up, we got Richard Nixon declaring the war on drugs 50 years ago last Thursday.
The Coffee Pod in Sumter, Oregon is your fast, friendly marijuana shop nestled in the beautiful Elkhorn Mountain Range outside of Baker City. We're serving Eastern Oregon and Idaho's Treasure Valley with a selection of flower, pre-rolls, vapes, dab, and edibles you need at the prices that make it well worth the drive. Don't venture to some well-watched parking lot in some border town dispensary just to take a number and wait in a long line for your cannabis products. Make the drive to the Coffee Pot in Sumter and deal one-on-one with your bud tender with no waiting. See, feel, and smell the products you're after and make your purchase knowing your tax dollars are helping a small tourist community that needs it. Plus, every dollar you spend is a point toward our Bong Bucks program that earns you coupons on glass and accessories. The Coffee Pot also honors our military, seniors, teachers, and first responders with a 10% discount. And as always, OMMP patients pay no 20% tax. Come on up to the Coffee Pot in Sumter, the first business on the left, on the side of the two-story log cabin restaurant, and tell them Radical Russ sent you.
You're not high. You're listening to the Russ Belville Show.
And the crime, and the gangs, and the drugs. This American carnage stops right now.
All right. Well, maybe you're high, too.
Radical Russ here, reminding you that marijuana legalization doesn't just happen. Smart, dedicated activists have put their freedom and future on the line to make it happen. Like the activists at SSDP, Students for Sensible Drug Policy. SSDP alumni are now leaders in marijuana journalism at Marijuana Moment, Marijuana Government in Massachusetts, and even leading the Drug Policy Alliance. Get involved with the SSDP chapter on your college campus or form one. Everything you need to get started can be found at ssdp.org. And keep it here on Radical Russ Radio for conversations with leaders from this organization, the best marijuana music, and the latest news about cannabis.
The world of cannabis is evolving at a frenetic pace. The Russ Belville Show gets behind the headlines to take a deeper look at breaking news in our Cannabis Focus.
Today in the Cannabis Focus, we're looking at 50 years ago yesterday, June 17th, 1971, when President Richard Nixon declared the war on drugs by calling drugs public enemy number one and dedicating the entire weight of the federal government to stamp out this scourge of drug addiction. Understand the context that just the year prior, the Supreme Court had declared the Marijuana Tax Act unconstitutional after being sued by Dr. Timothy Leary, and they were desperate to come up with some sort of way of controlling drugs. And that's where we lead to the drug war apparatus that we're still living with today. And just a year after this declaration, the Schaefer Commission declared that marijuana should be decriminalized. And of course, President Richard Nixon ignored that as well. Here now is the full 4-minute clip of President Nixon on live TV back in 1971, 50 years ago yesterday, declaring the war on drugs.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to summarize for you the meeting that I have just had with the bipartisan leaders, which began at 8 o'clock and was completed 2 hours later. I began the meeting by making this statement, which I think needs to be made to the nation. America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive. I have asked the Congress to provide the legislative authority and the funds to fuel this kind of an offensive. This will be a worldwide offensive dealing with the problems of sources of supply as well as Americans who may be stationed abroad, wherever they are in the world. It will be government-wide, pulling together the 9 different fragmented areas within the government in which this problem is now being handled. And it will be nationwide in terms of a new educational program that we trust will result as from the discussions that we have had. With regard to this offensive, it is necessary first to have a new organization. And the new organization will be within the White House. Dr. Jaffe, who will be one of the briefers here today, will be the man directly responsible. He will report directly to me. And he will have the responsibility to take all of the government agencies, nine, that deal with the problems of rehabilitation, in which his primary responsibilities will be research and education, and see that they work not at cross purposes, but work together in dealing with the problem. If we're going to have a successful offensive, we need more money. Consequently, I'm asking the Congress for $155 million in new funds, which will bring the total amount this year in the budget for drug abuse, both in enforcement and treatment, to over $350 million. As far as the new money is concerned, incidentally, I have made it clear to the leaders that if this is not enough, if more can be used, if Dr. Jaffe, after studying this problem, finds that we can use more, more will be provided. In order to defeat this enemy, which is causing such great concern, and correctly so to so many American families, money will be provided to the extent that it is necessary and to the extent that it will be useful. And finally, in order for this program to be effective, it is necessary that it be conducted on a basis in which the American people all join in it. That's why the meeting was bipartisan. Bipartisan because we needed the support of the Congress, but bipartisan because we needed the leadership of members of the Congress in this field. Fundamentally, it is essential for the American people to be alerted to this danger, to recognize that it is a danger that will not pass with the passing of the war in Vietnam, which has brought to our attention the fact that a number of young Americans have become addicts as they serve abroad, whether in Vietnam or Europe or other places. Because the problem existed before we became involved in Vietnam, it will continue to exist afterwards, and that is why this offensive deals with the problem there in Europe, but will then go on to deal with the problem throughout America. One final word with regard to presidential responsibility in this respect. I very much hesitate always to bring some new responsibility into the White House, because there are so many here, and I believe in delegating those responsibilities to the departments. But I consider this problem so urgent. I also found that it was scattered so much throughout the government, with so much conflict, without coordination, that it had to be brought into the White House, and consequently, I have brought Dr. Jaffe into the White House, directly reporting to me, so that we have not only the responsibility, but the authority to see that we wage this offensive effectively and in a coordinated way. The briefing team will now be ready to answer any questions on the technical details of the program.
That's Richard Nixon on June 17th, 1971, initiating the war on drugs. And I think one telling part about that quote is how he gets around to saying, this is going to give you $350 million, but boy, if you guys want more money, if we could give you more money, if you could be, find it useful to have more money, well, we'll give you that for, we'll give you that too. Now, come on, what government bureaucracy, hell, who out there in the private sector would turn down more money? And of course, we saw the war on drugs escalate to the point where the $350 million over 50 years turned into $3.1 billion that is dedicated to drug eradication in the federal budget at this point. $3.1 billion. A war on drugs that over the 50 years that it has been waged has cost us $1 trillion. $1,000 billion. $1 million million. However you want to figure it out. $1 trillion for the war on drugs. And the most annoying and disgusting part of this war on drugs is knowing that when Richard Nixon was up there declaring drug abuse to be public enemy number one, we know who he was really talking about. This came out in 1994. John Ehrlichman, former domestic policy chief for Richard Nixon, spoke to writer Dan Baum for Harper's Magazine. And in 94, he gave the quote in 94, and it got released in Harper's Magazine in 2006. John Ehrlichman said the following, quote, The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and the blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. End quote. Richard Nixon's domestic policy advisor admitting the game that public enemy number one wasn't drug abuse. Public enemy number one was the anti-war left and black people. It was leftist power and black power, which at the time there was a lot of overlap there with the Black Panthers setting up, you know, free meals and education and trying to help their communities. That's what it was about. This was a political war from the very beginning, a political war and a culture war. And now, 50 years later, we're starting to overcome that shameful legacy. We're starting to see the American people supporting the end of the war on drugs. We've got a poll on that coming up in the second hour. We'll tell you about who supports the end of the war on drugs and, surprisingly, where Democrats and Republicans agree on the issue. It's a little scary. Coming up in the next segment, we'll talk about the bipartisan war on drugs, how both Democrats and Republicans have contributed, and what some of the costs from that war on drugs have been. We already told you $1 trillion, but there's plenty more devastation from Richard Nixon's tragic folly. The war on drugs, it turned 50 years old yesterday. Radical Russ here for the Idaho Citizens Coalition for Cannabis. Since 2010, the members of the Idaho Citizens Coalition have been fighting to legalize marijuana in America's last absolute prohibition state. We believe Idahoans deserve legal access to the cannabis plant in all of its forms. Find out more about the Idaho Citizens Coalition at idahocan.co. That's idahocann.co. And find us on Facebook at IdahoCan.
You're listening to The Russ Belville Show.
I drank beer heavily and tried drugs enthusiastically.
You can find Radical Russ online everywhere.
In the interest of fair and balanced journalism, The Russ Belville Show presents the anti-drug public service announcement of the day.
In the next few months, the motion picture industry and theater owners we'll be bringing you a series of messages like the one you just saw. I don't think anybody will miss the point. The thrill can kill. The drug dealers need to know that we want them out of our schools, neighborhoods, and our lives. And the only way to do that is to take the customers away from the product. Say no to drugs and say yes to life.
Of course, your local drug pusher may tell you a little something different about these drugs. And who you believe is up to you. But then again, if you go ahead and try them, at least it won't be out of ignorance. Just stupidity. What would I do if someone offered me these drugs? I'd tell them to take a hike.
This has been the Russ Belville Show's anti-drug public service announcement of the day. Exclusively on RadicalRuss.com.
Minutes to 5 o'clock here in the Mountain Time Zone. Coming to you from the border of Idaho and Oregon. Couldn't be two more different states when you cross that river, let me tell you. The war on drugs has turned 50 years old. 50 years old in a day as of today. And I want to give you a breakdown of some of the costs, some of the devastation of this war on drugs. And as we do, let's keep in mind that it's been a bipartisan war on drugs. Yes, we had Richard Nixon, a Republican, who initiated the war on drugs. Then Jimmy Carter was president, and while he tried to de-escalate the war on drugs, he did actually call for Congress to decriminalize possession of an ounce of marijuana, but it went nowhere toward the end of his administration. And then, of course, that went on to the administration of Ronald Reagan, who escalated the war on drugs. And you heard his wife, Nancy, in the anti-drug public service announcement as a part of that escalation. And coming up in hour two, we're also going to take a look at how the war on drugs escalated in our media, how TV and movie producers were actually paid by our federal government to insert anti-drug storylines into popular TV shows and films. So that's coming up in hour two. But as far as some of the economic consequences and the carceral consequences, we talked about how since 1971, the war on drugs has cost the U.S. about $1 trillion. In 2015, the federal government spent $9.2 million every day to incarcerate people with a drug-related offense, $3.3 billion annually. This is all coming from a fact sheet presented by the Center for American Progress, and this was written in 2018, so might be 3 years off on the data, but it's still pretty compelling here. State governments spent another $7 billion in 2015, on top of the 3.3 spent by the federal government, another $7 billion in 2015 to incarcerate individuals for drug-related charges. So if you add up federal and state, we're talking $10 billion a year to keep people locked up for drugs. Now, when it comes to the people being locked up, every 25 seconds in 2018, people were being arrested for drug possession. Every 25 seconds, someone's getting arrested. The number of Americans arrested for possession has tripled since the 1980s, since 1980 itself, reaching 1.3 million arrests per year in 2015. And the arrests for possession are six times the arrests for sales. You know, oftentimes we hear about this law enforcement, we need to, you know, take away the dealers, we need to cut down the dealers. Well, one out of seven arrests is for a dealer. The rest are for people that are just using marijuana. One-fifth of the people who are incarcerated, that's 456,000 people, one-fifth of all the people in jail or prison are there for a drug charge. Another 1.15 million people on probation or parole for a drug charge. And it doesn't have much benefit. When we incarcerate people for a drug-related offense, it doesn't really reduce any substance abuse rates. It doesn't really help any. Instead, you lock someone up who's got a drug dependence issue, that's linked with increased mortality from overdose. Because what happens is you get them in prison, they've gone cold turkey, they get out of prison. First 2 weeks after release from prison, they're 13 times more likely to die than the general population. Why? Well, they go out, they've gotten cold turkey clean. Now they go out and they get their first fix. And what they thought was their limit is now no longer their limit. They got far, far lower ability to withstand the drug. They've got a tolerance for it. They've lost their tolerance for it. The leading cause of death among recently released individuals is overdose. And it doesn't really have much effect on public safety. Crime rates have gone down since the 1990s, and researchers attribute almost all of that to factors other than incarceration. Like, police and arrests and locking people up isn't what reduces crime. That's a reaction to crime. That's how you deal with crime after it's happened. If you want to stop crime from happening, you get people educated. You get people better pay, better jobs, a social safety net, mental health care. These are the things. Birth control. A surprising amount of the reduction in crime is attributable to the legalization of abortion in 1971 as well. That's right. Look up authors that wrote the book Freakonomics. I think that if I remember correctly, they attributed about 30% of the decline in crime rates since the 1990s to the fact that that's the age where the young men who'd be 15 to 19 to 21 who got aborted after 1971, they were no longer around to commit the crime. I know it sounds crazy when you say it like that, but it's true. giving people access to family planning, giving people a safety net, giving them something to live for, and taking away a large degree of the desperation in their life, not only reduces crime, it reduces the use of drugs too. But it's a whole lot easier to have politicians demagogue on being tough on crime and tough on drugs, and we're going to lock people up and throw away the key and three strikes and you're out, as if that's a solution to the problem. No, it's a reaction to the problem. It doesn't stop people from using drugs. The entire point of addiction is the fact that you cannot stop, that you will not react to negative consequences for your use. So locking people up, reducing their tolerance, taking them out of being able to get the drugs they're used to, relying on whatever gets smuggled into the prison, that's the effects that we've had from these 50 years of this drug war, and it's time to end it. And of course, what it's done to the communities of America, the minority communities, and with respect to our law enforcement community. You know, there used to be a time when we revered the beat cop, and it was, you know, to protect and serve, and they were the guy you would call for when something's going wrong. Now, it's no longer to protect and serve. It's to search and seize. It's to stop and frisk. It's to manufacture some way to make a drug arrest that's an easy, provable case that comes with lots of overtime for the cops, instead of doing real police work to stop real criminals, violent people, rapists, child abusers. Those cases are harder. They require investigation. They require more solid proof and sourcing. The war on drugs has ruined policing and ruined communities of color's interactions and relationship with policing. Black people are 4 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana than white people. Black people make up 30% of all drug arrests, except they're only 12.5% of all people who use drugs. They're 6 times more likely to be incarcerated for a drug-related offense than a white person, even though black and white people use drugs at about the same rates. 80% of the people serving time for a federal drug offense are black or Latino. In state prisons, it's 60% for drug charges. The average defendant convicted for a drug offense will serve the same amount of time, about 58 months on average, as a white offender for a violent crime, 61 months. Let me say that again. In the federal prison system, a black guy convicted for drugs is going to stay in prison about the same amount of time as a white guy convicted of a violent crime. And when it comes to charging, the people of color are 70% of all defendants convicted with mandatory minimum sentences. Prosecutors are twice as likely to seek a mandatory minimum for a black defendant, and black defendants are less likely to receive relief from mandatory minimum sentences. This is all part of this war on drugs, and speaking of those mandatory minimum sentences, we can thank the current president of the United States, Joe Biden. That's his bipartisan contribution to all this, having been the author of the crime bill, the 1994 Clinton crime bill that helped put 100,000 cops on the street and to help ramp up mass incarceration. He was a driving force between the anti-drug abuse acts of 86 and 88. He wrote in the Office of National Drug Control Policy, created the Drug Czar's Office. So this has been a bipartisan war on drugs for the past 50 years, and it's good that we're finally having a bipartisan response to getting rid of it. We'll talk a little bit about that in hour two, how we've got new bills to end the war on drugs that are coming up, and we have lots of support. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, time for a radical rant. Treat marijuana like Indian casinos.
Time for Idaho to join the rest of the nation in legalizing medical marijuana. The volunteers at Kind Idaho have proposed the Idaho Medical Marijuana Act and are collecting signatures now to place it on the ballot. Visit kindidaho.org to learn more. Become a volunteer signature gatherer for Kind Idaho to help collect the over 65,000 signatures needed to put medical marijuana on the November 2022 ballot. Polls show it will pass. Please visit kindidaho.org today.
You're not high.
You're listening to the Russ Belville Show.
Some of the people who were taking marijuana for those purposes, the coroner believed after they died there was drug interactions.
Okay, maybe you're high too.
And now, Puff Pass Ponder with Radical Russ. If tickets, fines, and a mandatory trip to rehab are supposed to save society from the harms of marijuana, how come nobody proposes them for beer? This has been Puff Pass Ponder with Radical Russ.
Warning. Hits taken on this show are larger than they appear. Do not try this at home. These people are professionals. Or at least they pay me to say that.
Hey, man. Am I driving okay?
A public service message from the Russ Belville Show.
Now, as a service to listeners considering the use of pharmaceutical medications that, unlike marijuana, are approved for medical use by the Federal Food and Drug Administration, the Russ Belville Show presents the Big Pharma Ad of the Day.
Jardiance can reduce the risk of cardiovascular death for adults who also have known heart disease, so it could help save your life from a heart attack or stroke. And it lowers A1C.
Jardiance can cause serious side effects, including a rare but life-threatening bacterial infection in the skin of the perineum.
Whoa, wait a minute. Say that again?
A rare but life-threatening bacterial infection.
Life-threatening infection?
In the skin of the perineum.
That spot between my genitals and my anus?
A rare but life-threatening bacterial infection in the skin of the perineum could occur. Stop taking Jardiance.
Medical marijuana.
Right, if you have symptoms,
not recommended by the FDA, but it won't cause fatal taint rot.
We must wage what I have called total war against public enemy number one.
I support a change in law to end federal criminal penalties for possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
That marijuana, pot, grass, whatever you want to call it, is probably the most dangerous drug.
Some think there won't be room for them in jail. We'll make room.
I experimented with marijuana a time or two, and I didn't like it, and didn't inhale.
One major responsibility is to encourage people to use less drugs.
Entirely legitimate topic for debate.
Radical Rant.
Connecticut is poised to become the 19th state to legalize adult use of marijuana, and as part of the roller coaster ride the bill took this week, it faced a potential veto from the governor if the legislators did not fix problems that he saw with its call for social equity. And social equity, of course, is the idea that the ending of the war on marijuana and the beginning of commercialized marijuana should help to repair and recompense people whose lives and neighborhoods and communities were devastated by the war on drugs. We just told you some of the statistics about this, of how Black people and Latino people have borne the brunt of the war on drugs, with being more likely to be busted, more lengthily incarcerated, more harshly treated in every aspect of the war on drugs. And so the governor, what I understand from the reports, was upset that the social equity provision was one that would grant that status to someone who had been previously convicted under the war on drugs, someone who'd been busted for weed, for growing it, for selling it. And apparently that was a problem because under that sort of standard, a rich white guy could qualify. Hey, there's certain, you know, some rich people, every now and then it happens, rich white guys get busted too. And so some guy who might have had a weed bust from, you know, 1990 when he was in college, then grew up to become some hedge fund manager, would then be eligible as a social equity applicant. So that, of course,
had to be changed. And I believe the fix was to come up with an income cap, which is also somewhat problematic because then you're saying the black person who grew up in the hood that was over-policed, who got a marijuana bust while he was young in the 90s, who then became an MBA and made a whole bunch of money, they wouldn't be available as a social equity applicant, even though it was their neighborhood and they had to overcome living in that neighborhood and the over-policing of the war on drugs, but they wouldn't be eligible either. And it just points to what I believe is bending over backwards to try to do something that is racial without looking like you're doing something that is racial. Do you get my point? Because what I really believe is happening here is that people are upset by the idea that there was a war on drugs that busted black and brown people. But now that it's going to be legal, those same black and brown people who were busted for selling weed in the past aren't able to sell weed legally in the future because it's now a legal commodity. And with everything in capitalism that's a legal commodity, it takes money to get involved. It takes money to hire, you know, your people. It takes money for the overhead. It takes money for licensing. It takes money. And who has money in this nation? White people. Why? Well, for years, for slavery, from Jim Crow, from redlining, from all sorts of reasons. But somehow, marijuana becoming a legal commodity is supposed to overcome capitalism. Marijuana is supposed to be unique among all products and not favor rich white guys. Well, if that's the point, if that's what we're trying to do, let's just stop mincing words. Let's just say, hey, we don't want white people to get rich on this. No white people allowed. No more white folks getting involved in the marijuana industry. Let's just treat it like Indian casinos. I have a friend who's a member of a tribe. And this friend gets more money income per month than I make in 2 years. And that income, that money coming in as a monthly check, is a stipend. It's just part of the profits from that tribe's casino that they have. And that money just rolls in, and that person gets to, you know, spend a whole bunch of money on a lot of stuff just because the tribe owns a casino. And because when we started the gaming industry, originally only Atlantic City and Las Vegas allowed for casinos. But then we relented and let Indian tribes start to have casinos because they're on their own tribal land, so they have some sovereignty, a sovereignty that we usually ignore for most things, you know, land, water, you know, run a pipeline through the land. We don't care about their sovereignty in that case. But in this one case, having casinos so that we white people can go and gamble and have fun, we'll let you have some sovereignty there. So we gave the casino industry, in large part, I know there's riverboat casinos and other casinos now, but in the beginning when it started, we gave the casino industry in large part to the Native Americans. Now, that's a different kind of situation because they are sovereign nations within the United States. So there's a different legal aspect to it. They own their own land, unlike, you know, black people generally don't have their own reservations and such. But if we're really talking about what we need to do is to end the war on drugs so that black people can benefit it, so we can fix black neighborhoods, let's just say it. Let's just do it. Let's come up with a bill called the Cannabis Industry Reparations Act, or whatever you want to call it. And we'll say, look, sorry, black people, about the slavery, about the Jim Crow, about the redlining, about all the injustices you felt. You deserve reparations. We absolutely should recompense you for the theft of your lives, your families, your cultures, your labor, your wealth. Absolutely. Nothing we do could ever fully repay that sin debt. Nothing America could ever do could fully repay it. But we will give you the weed industry. You can have the weed industry. The weed industry is for black people only. If you want to own a dispensary, you have to be black. Your growers, 50% have to be black. A majority of your growers have to be black or Latino. A majority of your bud tenders have to be black or Latino. Let's just do it. Let's just say so. Let's just give the hell, make it the whole drug industry. Since we're ending the war on drugs, you can distribute the marijuana, the cocaine, the heroin, the MDMA, the
You know what? Let's give the psychedelics to the hippies, though. Let's give the white hippies the psychedelics, though. Because you go back to that Ehrlichman quote that I gave to you at the top of the hour. Remember, the Nixon was trying to fight the anti-war left, a.k.a. the white hippies, and the blacks, black power. So, okay, so since the war on drugs targeted the white hippies and the blacks, we'll give the blacks the most of the drugs, but the whites, white hippies, and you got to be a hippie. Can't just be any old white guy MBA. You have to have long hair and Birkenstocks and more than 3 tie-dye t-shirts and a bootleg recording of the Dead. If you've got all of those things, then you, Mr. White Hippie, can be part of the psychedelics industry. Although the natives are going to want the peyote and some of the other stuff. So maybe just the chemical psychedelics like the MDMAs, the DMTs, LSDs, you know, the alphabet stuff. The natural stuff, will let the natives keep that. Or, hey, let's go back to, you know, the original. You know, the original war on drugs began with the banning of Chinese opium dens. So perhaps the opioids, we'll let the Asians have the opioids. The blacks can have the marijuana and the heroin and the cocaine, the plant-based drugs there, marijuana, heroin, cocaine. And then the entheogens, the psychedelics, that's the white hippies. They get to have that. I'm being somewhat facetious here, but I'm trying to make a point. And the point is, let's just get to the root of what we're trying to do. Because I think what's left unsaid in a lot of this is that by ending the war on drugs, we're taking money out of those communities. Because those communities have relied on the side hustle for a long time now. Now, that's not to blame. If you're locked out of other industries, if you're locked out of getting better education, then slinging bags of weed on the street might be your only option. And now we're taking that option away. Let's be honest. Legalizing weed means we're putting a bunch of black and brown weed dealers out of business. So if we're being honest and saying, hey, we're hurting them because we're taking their illicit business, then we need to legalize their business. That's the other problem we've had with legalizing marijuana. We said legalize marijuana, we didn't say how. We should have been saying legalize what people are doing with marijuana now. Legalize the weed dealer with the backpack and the Ziploc baggies. Legalize that guy. Sure, we could have some minimal amount of licensing. Maybe a yearly license costs $200 or something. Maybe a yearly inspection of the grow. But you don't want to put too much overhead on that, or he's just going to go back to being the illegal weed dealer. Let's just be honest about what we're trying to do, though. And when I see Representative Cori Bush and other people saying, you know, the war on drugs was against a war. She said the war on drugs was a war on black and brown people. Again, ignores the fact of the hippies, the liberal hippies, the white hippies they were going after, too. I personally have 2 friends who have each done over 2 decades in prison for nonviolent marijuana offenses, both white men. So yes, the war on drugs devastated the black and brown community. We won't get away from that, especially on Juneteenth. But let's not forget that the war on drugs had collateral damage of all races, of all people, of all communities. That's all the time we got for hour 1. Stay tuned. Hour 2 is next with a look at the war on drugs on TV. Clips from Different Strokes, Home Improvement. I forget which one the other one, but I can get there. Oh, Saved by the Bell. We got to have the Saved by the Bell. For everyone here in America's last absolute prohibition state, I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers. You're growing, you're trying to roam it, you're smoking, and it goes down smooth.